even for those companies that we use Notion, we use local tools like Soho Creator, we use Glide for creating our portfolio and demo for the sales team.
Hello, everyone. Welcome again to the Low Code Podcast. I'm very excited today to welcome Eddie Prado. He's from Venezuela. He lives in Miami, and he's a founder that has a great track record, and that's what I want to talk about today. He scaled an app to hundreds of thousands of users, and I want to understand how he did it, what he learned on that process, on that journey, and hopefully you can get some action points when you're scaling your idea or your app. So, Eddie, welcome to the Low Code Podcast, and thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you. Thank you, Jesus, for inviting me. It's a pleasure. I mean, and as a founder and an entrepreneur, I know how important it is to share knowledge to others, fellow founders and entrepreneurs. That's the only way we can succeed to, all together and grow the ecosystem. So I'm happy to be here and share my experience and try to help others.
I appreciate that. So tell us, let's start by you telling us a little bit about your journey. You grew up in Venezuela and then you left in the
2012, yes.
12, right. And then ended up in the States, right?
Yes.
When did this idea of building an app start?
Well, actually, we started in Venezuela with a small, like a dev shop. Like local agency, but with code, with actual real code. Okay. we started making projects for other businesses like restaurants, hotels. Did some like in education. Like we did several industries, mobile apps, Android and iOS native.
Okay.
And that we started. We started growing the team. After 3 years doing that, we were like maybe 30 something people.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, building apps, mainly in Venezuela and other countries in Latin America, Colombia, Mexico, basically Panama. And after a while, we always had some like crazy ideas within the team, like, hey, we should do this new social media, or we should do this, whatever, right? And after a while, we said, okay, we have the experience, we have the team, we have learned how to build successful apps for other companies. Let's try to do some like a small project to see how it goes. And we picked a mobile game. Like a super like casual game in the trivia category. It was a game that was very popular in Europe back then. And we said, hey, let's try to make it in Spanish, right? With a small twist. We wanted to leverage like back then Twitter was booming and you know, Facebook was starting to be a thing. So we said, hey, let's build on top like the social component, like sharing, like, you know, asking friends for help on social media, like involving the friends and the community. And we did that. We took it took us like maybe 3 to 6 months, one designer, one developer, and myself. We set like a, you know, like as a side project. And and after 6 months we launched it. And after maybe, you know, I don't know, a few months, it started picking up randomly.
Why did it pick up?
I'm going to be honest. We don't know for sure. We spent like a year and a half with a dedicated team, analytics team, try to understand why and where and when exactly pick it up. And I mean, I can tell some hypotheses and theories, but we never, the most credible hypothesis was someone in, I think, Puerto Rico shared the game. Some like influencer in Twitter back then shared on her Twitter. I think it was a lady on her Twitter account, and it started growing from them. I think, I mean, we think that was it. But to be honest, it was because when we built the app, we didn't have enough analytics tool and stuff. Like, we were just learning how to build a game, right? So we were not prepared to like, oh yeah, let's build this like super massive project. It was like a more like a fun project. So, but after that, we learned a lot about user acquisition and about organic growth. Right. Actually, we never spent like maybe 1.5% of our user base was acquired paid user acquisition.
Okay.
And the other 90%.
Was it a free app? How do you make money?
Yeah, free. Yeah, it was a free. Yeah, ads and in-app purchase.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. you can buy hints and coins to like power ups, stuff like that too.
What worked better? Where do you make more money from, ads or
in upsets? Latin America, ads. In Latin America, 100% ads.
Right.
But like in 2014, there was not a culture of people spending money on their United States, because later we translated like we launched the game in 9 different languages. In worldwide, so in like tier one countries, technologically speaking, in-app purchases was of course why we're driving most of the revenue.
That's interesting. So you had this idea. I mean, you validated the idea because you saw the concept working somewhere else.
Yes. We started working something else. We then said, hey, let's bring it into Spanish, because back then it was only like in Germany and in English.
Okay.
But British English, right? So we said, hey, let's start in Spanish. But the difference was, okay, let's build this in Spanish, localized. Not only like a translation, but you know, you have to localize because it was a trivia game. So the questions and stuff like that, like the riddles, were localized, and I think we did a great job doing that, because everyone thinks outside Latin America, everyone thinks like, okay, because you speak Spanish, you always like talk the same, like, but you know that it's totally different. The Spanish that Argentinians that they speak in Argentina and Mexico and Colombia and Venezuela, right? So we tried to make the game as neutral as possible.
Okay.
And I think we did a great job, because everyone in social media were trying to guess like, oh no, I think the founders are from Colombia. No, I think they're from Mexico. I think they're from Venezuela. No, they're from Dominican Republic. So people couldn't guess where the company who created the game were from, because we tried to be as neutral as possible. That was one, I think, key of success. And the other one, it's the social component. We consciously decided to, hey, let's build the game, but let's put some virality loop into that. Like, hey, when you get stuck, ask your friend for help, post it. Like, we make it easy for people to share on social media. We encourage that during the whole game.
Okay.
Not being annoying, but encouraging, to share on social media. And
I have two questions about that. So first, do you think that is still a good way to grow an app? And the other question is, how do you figure out? I mean, it's part of defining the user journey and the user roles and all that, but how do you make it a good experience for the end user? Because the line between bothering them and providing a good experience is a very fine line, or it's a very gray area. Right. So how do you make it work? Did you test a lot and change that component, or did you do a lot of user research?
What we tried to do is the best way to do that kind of those kind of features into your app. It could be an app, it could be a game, whatever, right? Is to make the end user feel that you're trying to help them.
Okay.
If they do that. Like, they're going to get, when they notice that by sharing or by doing whatever action you want them to do, you as a developer are going to get more benefit that then by doing it, then that's when it becomes annoying, right?
Okay. Why
you're asking me to do this because it's beneficial for you, right? Because you want me to promote your app. But on the contrary, if you're suggesting them, hey, if you do this, whatever, right? Whatever you do, share on social media or whatever. If you do this, it's beneficial for you. I'm trying to help you. Then it becomes, hey, these guys are my ally, my partners. They want to help me progress in the game or achieve more with this app. So you have to, whatever actions you want them to do, you have to provide them value. So in our case, it's you have three options to help you progress along the game. Number one, buy, right? Purchase and ins or whatever, or in-app purchases. Number two, watch an ad or whatever, right? Or number three, ask your friends for help. Not share the game. Not, hey, check out this game. It's like, it's not like, hey, check out this game, download it. Or I'm playing this game. Uh-huh. Right? It's like, hey, I'm stuck here. Could you please help me answer this puzzle, trivia, question, whatever, or in order for me to get to the next level?
Okay.
So by sharing, I'm asking for help. So we designed a like a viral loop, right? Because when you share at the beginning, everyone were sharing like a screenshots, right? Whatever. But soon we realized that it was going to be way better to instead of sharing the screenshot, sharing like an actual playable, very mini version of the game. So when you share on social media, everyone was trying to, it was playing on their browser, not downloading the game. On their browser, trying to help you.
Oh, it was a little web app.
It was a little web app. Exactly. So when Jesus shared on his Twitter account, hey, can anyone help me guess this puzzle, whatever, I don't know the answer. When I click on that link that you share, I'm playing the same puzzle that you're playing. And as soon as I get the answer, you will receive a push notification on your app, on your game, saying, hey, so one of your friends help you out, this is the answer. And you will click, get in there, and keep moving forward. And myself, that I just teased like the game. I just played the web mini version of the game. Said, "Hey, this looks cool. This looks nice." So after I help you, there was like a message saying like, "Hey, you want to keep playing the full version of the game? Download it here."
That's pretty cool. Is that something unique, or was at the time was that something unique in the play?
Yeah. Yes, actually,
on the game industry.
We have a patent for that system. It's called Viral 360.
Nice. And that's how you grew. That was the secret recipe for growing.
Yeah. That's how we went from.
That's amazing.
When we did that, we already had 1 million, about 1 million downloads. So by the sharing the screenshots or whatever, like, we do that, but we went from 1 million to 40 million by doing that.
And then what happened? Did you end up selling that?
Yes, we ended up selling that game. A couple of years ago, to a public company in Europe.
Nice, cool. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
We sold the game. We didn't sell the proprietary technology.
Correct.
We just sold the title. The IP.
Okay. Did you make more games?
We did make a couple of more games. Maybe three games, three to five games. We got another one, very successful, not as successful as this one. It is called Letter Master, also in the world trivia category.
Mm-hmm.
We got maybe 10 million downloads with that one.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, but
is that a good number? I mean, if you get 10 million downloads, are you in the top, 5% of apps?
It depends. 1%? It depends. I don't know nowadays. But just to give you an example with AppenStar or Wordy, how it's called in English, we got with those 40 million downloads, we got top 10 most downloaded games in 160 countries.
Okay.
So, wow. and with Lettermaster, maybe we did it in, with the, those 10 millions, maybe we did it in 50 out of the like countries, okay. Top 10, like maybe 40, 50 countries.
That's pretty cool.
We also launched the Disney version of AppenStar.
Okay.
Disney characters and more for younger audience, for kids.
Right. That's pretty cool. So you grew a gaming company, an app gaming company.
Yeah.
App games, right?
Yeah.
Most of our clients are building more niche apps, right? More specific for their industry. So think an app for lawyers or an app for, we have a client and we recorded an episode last week about an app that helps people that are getting out of jail follow through a lot of complicated processes that they have to go when they get out of jail, right? They have to check in with their case manager. So the app helps them do that flow. So their niche is very specific. 500,000 people come out of jail every year. And then from those 500,000, there's a specific niche of people. What would you say, based on your experience of growing apps, growing user bases, what would you suggest these founders that are building these very unique apps for very specific niches? What would you suggest them in terms of how can they get users?
Yeah, what I always advise other entrepreneurs, it's no matter where or what you want to build. In this case, it's very, very, totally very different market. Gaming, you always have to go where your user base is. So let me give you an example. If I'm trying to build a SaaS company, right, a B2B SaaS. Okay, and my industry that I'm going after, it's the automobile industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Building something for automobile companies. And then I have to go with all the trade shows, the events where those companies are, right? Or the decision makers of those companies are. But if I'm trying to build an app for people hanging out in bars or restaurants, whatever, you have to go after the foodie communities,
right?
Whatever you're trying to, which audience trying to go after, try to find where the most loyals and the more engaged users are, right? Maybe they hang out in Slack channels, groups, or they do on Discord, or they are on Facebook
group.
Yeah, whatever, right. Facebook groups. You have to go up after them in both, in the online world and in the offline world. Sometimes we said, oh no, yeah, they are all hanging out in Twitter and they are in, I don't know, Clubhouse, doing Clubhouse rooms or sessions. And yes, that's a one way. But where do those people gather in maybe if applied in the offline world, as I mentioned, they do these events, they do these meetups every month, once a month on in this square, on this plaza, whatever, right? So you have to go after them, but go chase the most engaged users or the decision makers or the, like, go after them. And then start talking to them. Not only showing, but talking to them, just talk 20% and then listen 80%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because
that's really
sometimes,
nice.
Sometimes we are so excited about our project and about our idea that we just like talk and then say, oh yeah, and the app will do this and the app will have this feature and we're thinking in the future to partner with and do this and do that and it will fireworks and yeah, okay, cool. What does it do today?
Right.
And how does it sound to you? Like, is that something you're interested in? What is your main pain points? Like, listen to their main pain points. As entrepreneurs, we always make the mistake. I haven't met one entrepreneur, at least successful entrepreneur, who haven't made the mistake of thinking they know what their user wants. We 9 out of 10 we are wrong.
We see that all the time. We build an app, and then a few weeks later, they come back and say, "Hey, my users actually don't think this way. We thought this way. They don't. We have to change the flow." Yeah, it's very normal. Very normal. Yeah, mm-hmm. Getting user feedback is very
it's key.
Challenging and humbling because it makes you understand that what you have in mind might not be what they're willing to pay for or they might be willing to use.
Yeah, I remember one time I'm in the advisory board of one app that tackles the political parties, right? And okay. I don't know much about the political industry, like, you know, the politics industry, right? But I remember stopping by, like finding in my city where in this case I live in the United States, where the Democrats and Republicans, where they meet, where they are like the main meetups. And I started attending to those meetups and try to listen to like what were their main pain points and what they want to achieve and what is important for them. So I was able to give them proper advice to this company, right? I translate what I was listening and hearing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Then technologically, how can this company can tackle that opportunity, et cetera, et cetera. Similar with we tried to launch was an app for CPG companies like consumer product goods, like you know the mm-hmm. the Unilevers or Procter's, or,
right? P&G, Coca-Cola,
yeah,
right.
But for food, more like PepsiCo,
okay,
food, right? Where they can determine way faster what's out of a stock in the shelves, so they can restock it faster than right now because they're losing like it's a revenue opportunities there, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I remember for 1 month visiting like three times a week all the like you know biggest supermarkets and try to understand and during those visits I met with companies and teams doing like you know the inventory checks and stuff like that. And I talked to them, hey, how you do inventory? What is your main challenge? Like, and I learned a lot. I tried. And at the end, that project didn't grow up because there were another challenges. But I was able to determine those challenges faster because I was in the field, like talking to, like, to the people who are in the field,
end user, whatever. Right. Yeah. Yeah, you weren't in your computer thinking about what they might have.
You have to go there.
You weren't there.
Yeah, you have to go there and do the job. Like, actually, go to the place, try to talk to them, listen to them. Like,
that makes sense. Now, I want to change the topic a little bit. You are a software engineer. You have built apps. You have built a lot of software. And now you are in the no-code movement. A lot of software engineers don't like no code. They feel, I don't know, challenge. I don't fully understand because at the end, no code and low code tools help them as well. But you have really embraced no code, right? How do you find no code? Why do you think it's very valuable? What do you don't like about no code, especially coming from a technical background?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, even though I'm a system engineer, I always try to, my passion were always focused on the user experience, right? So the user experience is the intersection between the technical part and the graphic front end UI part, right? You know, it's where those two components, very important components of a technical app meet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing I had to do is to learn about designing, right? Because I'm not a designer, right? So after I graduated, the first, I don't know, 3 years, 4 or 5 years of my career was learning about UI, right? About the correct way to present, like the most effective way to present interfaces to users, et cetera, right?
Okay.
And that took me away from coding quite a bit. So when I tried to catch up, a lot of things was happening, right? Even though I can understand code I can talk to any developer and they can present it to challenges and I can try to figure out how to do it, right? But starting from scratch, I wasn't like, you know, the best developer because I was a little bit outdated. So I always focus on like, you know, the managing of the team, like the UX, project manager, PM, et cetera, right? Then, but I always had like, you know, my side projects, trying to, I'm an early adopter in technology. So if anything comes new, I try to test it first and I see how it
right. goes.
And I remember I was trying to do, I don't remember exactly what I was trying to do. And I have the UI for it. Like I built some UI with, I don't know, with Webflow or something like that. I don't remember what. I built some UI. And I was trying to connect to the backend, right? But that always has been my challenge, how to connect to the backend. And then I found Zapier. And then my whole universe of ideas expanded because of Zapier. Yeah. So now I can connect any backend with any frontend like without knowing code. And that's how I started, my passion of the no-code tools, right? So I said, okay, if there is a way of connecting front end and back end without coding, then it should be a way of doing this without coding. And then it should be a way of doing that without coding, like, you know? And then I started it's just making the right questions. Like, you know, like people doesn't even think about going to Google and says, how can I build a social network without coding? They don't even think about this question because they don't think it's possible, right? The status quo, I need to know how to code in order to build a tech company or an app or
software,
whatever.
App. Right.
It's so embedded in the society mindset that no one even dare to go
searches
to Google.
Or,
to go to Google and says, hey, how to build this without coding? Like, you know, how to build a Uber without coding, how to build an Airbnb without coding. So I started asking those questions to Google and then the answers were fascinating. Like that's how I discovered a lot of no code tools. And that's how that's one part. And the second part is like, I just talk about the most successful, one of the most successful projects that I have worked. But I will need another podcast to talk about the failures, right?
Right, it's all the failed projects.
Yeah, so I have a list of at least 20 projects that we tried to launch or whatever, where either we lose years, we lose money, we lose like a lot. So after losing a lot of money and a lot of time, I start asking myself, like, hey, how can I build this in 1 week or in 1 month, right? I started in 1 month, then 3 weeks, then 2 weeks, then 1 week, then one weekend, right? So how can I build or validate this idea without needing to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, time with developer time, like, you know what I mean? So that's the second reason why I was super passionate about no-code tools, because they are the best way right now that I know of to validate ideas without much money and much time. So and as an entrepreneur, you learn the hard way that time and money, like everything that saves you time and money, it brings you closer to a successful project.
Right. That makes sense. Are you using no code tools for your own projects, or are you building something around no code?
Yes, all the time. Even for the companies that I'm working right now, like the companies that I'm founder right now. I'm a founder of Admazing. It's a mobile gaming advertisement agency, and Fastmind. It's a SaaS tool for enterprise to increase their help them increase their conversion rate. Digital ads conversion rates.
Okay.
Even for those companies that we use Notion, we use low-code tools like Soho Creator. We use Glide for creating our portfolio and demo for the sales team. When they want to, like when they're in the streets with a client and when they want to, hey, show me what you have done in the past, whatever. So for portfolio, we build a small app in Glide. So even for our own companies, we use no-code tools every day and try to optimize and whatever. And when an entrepreneur, a friend, whatever, asks me, hey, how can I have this idea, how can I do it or whatever, 9 out of 10, I recommend using no-code tools for validating ideas. I think it's one of the best things for entrepreneurs who wants to validate ideas cheap and fast are no-code tools.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. So where can people follow you? Are you active on Twitter? Should they follow you on LinkedIn? Where can they learn more about you?
Yeah, you can follow me on any social media. It's Eddie, EDDYJ. That's my second name, Jose, Eddie J. Prado. So Twitter. Lately, I have been more active on Twitter than Instagram or LinkedIn, but I check them all. I'm trying to be at least a little bit engaged on all of them. But yeah, Eddie J. Prado, follow me.
That's great. We'll have to do soon another episode about talking about the failures and talking about what you're doing now, which a couple of very interesting projects and industries that we don't know about or I don't know about a lot.
It's super interesting how we went from B2C to B2B.
Right, exactly, to B2B. Yeah, completely different industry.
Yeah, it's totally different monster, yeah.
Thanks so much for joining.
I really enjoyed this, and I hope your audience, your listeners, will learn a little bit. So if I can avoid them, at least one of my mistakes, I think we're all.
It was worth it.
The job is done. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm sure it has been very helpful for all of us. All right, Rudy. Thank you.
Thank you.